Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we welcome back the usual suspects. Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery is in the corner office with a Maduro cigar. He'll be joining us via the phone lines. Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum at Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery here in Studio A, San Cigar. Give us a call, 800-348-2551 if you have a gardening question. 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Make it a paragraph, not four pages, and we may get to it. It's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Fred and Bob and Greg and your gardening calls coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we have the crew with us. Bob Graves is co-owner of Fadigan's Nursery in Latham, New York. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And we welcome your gardening calls right now. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email, if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org. But the number is 800-348-2551. Any time of year, this is a very crowded show. So while there are a couple of open lines, get in line now. 800-348-2551. Fred Breglia, welcome back, sir. How are you?
Hey, it's great to be back, Ray. Thanks for having us.
Thanks again for bringing more of the potatoes. They're delicious.
They are really great. It's potato season, so I'm glad you guys can enjoy them.
It's potato season.
It is. Well, it's a little bit past now.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're not in the ground. It could be.
I know martini season is done, but it's potato season now. And so, you know, we fried the last batch. You brought four or five last time. These are finger potatoes, they call them?
They are. They call them finger potatoes because basically they're not going to get much larger than a really large arthritic finger.
Right. Like mine.
Whereas the other potatoes, when you get them, sometimes they call them fresh potatoes or new potatoes. They'll often skim off some of the top potatoes on a plant that produces large potatoes.
Yeah.
And you get those young right. potatoes or fresh potatoes. These are at maturity and obviously flavor comes
so
full
good.
Force.
Yeah. And, you know, we just cut them in medallions and threw them in a pan and fried them up. Oh, yeah.
I think potatoes are on the menu tonight for both of us.
Bob Graves, you brought nothing, but you're here. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's nice to have a couple weeks here when we didn't get rained on every day.
I hear that.
Ground is still nice and moist. It's great for plants going into the winter that the ground is nice and moist, that plants will be well hydrated.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll welcome from the corner office at Ward's Nursery, Greg Ward. How you doing, Greg?
You know, Ray, I'm doing really well, and I feel really impressed that you invited me along. You had a couple of great guys there.
We always invite you along. What do you mean? You're part of the crew. I mean, it would be nice if you were here.
And I also apologize for not actually being there. It's just too many little things, and next time, I promise.
You know, if this was commercial radio, we'd send a car for you, but it's public radio, and we have to have another fund drive for that, so you're on your own, man. Bob, let's get back to digging in the dirt. I had a conversation with one of my colleagues in the newsroom. Mm-hmm. Let's just call him Lucas Willard, and he wanted to know what is good to plant right now, before the winter, before the spring.
Well, there's a lot of argument that for trees and shrubs in particular, now is an excellent time because roots still continue to grow until the ground freezes pretty solid.
Yeah.
And so we've got a number of growing weeks. And the reason that's an advantage is that when you get into the hot, dry weather of next year, you already have roots established.
Right.
The problem this time of year is you probably can't find what you want because most of us in the garden center nursery business are trying to reduce our inventories
right.
at this point.
But on the flip side, on a good positive note, sometimes you can get some great deals. At the garden
sometimes
centers.
You can get some great
yeah.
deals.
Yeah, because
now.
A lot of times we just don't want to hold them, and things even out of left over after our fall sale, we said,
absolutely.
You know, liquidate them out. It was a handful of things. Some people walked away with some great plants
absolutely.
At a great price.
Very cool. All right, a few emails here, and then we'll get right to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. This one came in quite a while back from Mona. Well, not that far back. Mona writes, I live at 1,850 feet on a mountain in Bern with good sun and clayish soil. Is it possible to grow a ginkgo tree up here?
And the answer to that is yes. Absolutely.
What's a ginkgo tree?
Ginkgo tree is the oldest tree species that we have alive on the earth today. So they're a prehistoric plant. And now its native range is pretty much, you know, non-existent. But the lineage lives on, and the tree's lineage dates back to dinosaurs. It's literally one of the oldest.
It's something most garden centers and nurseries will carry routinely.
Yeah.
Yep. They are a bit slow. They don't grow real fast.
Yep.
But they are a magnificent tree.
And they can get large. And they definitely, they're hardy. Big. You can definitely get away with putting
them. What about the clayish soil, though? Is that okay?
That's got to be fine. The arboretum, we've got a lot of ginkgos, and the soil's predominantly clay.
Clay isn't bad. Sand isn't bad. What's bad is really wet ground. You know, if it's soggy, wet, standing water, that's a problem. But clay ground is not bad to grow in.
That's right. Yep. So the ginkgo, as long as you're not putting it in a real wet spot, it's gonna thrive.
Greg Ward, do you sell a lot of ginkgos over there?
We don't sell a lot of them, but like Bob said, we do offer them pretty consistently every year, and they are really a fun tree. One of the really interesting aspects is that when the frost finally hits them, they'll drop every leaf in 24 hours. It rains leaves.
Wow.
We've got a carpet under that tree.
We got a big one at the nursery, and it's amazing. The leaves are on it, and then the next day, they're gone.
This one came in from Mary, and Mary writes, Mary in Rensselaerville, who says she loves the show. I have fallen far behind this fall in either raking up or mulching the many, many leaves in my yard. Can I keep the leaves on my grass for the winter? If so, do I need to rake them up in the spring or just let them decompose in place?
Yeah, that's something we like to see people change their approach to that. Don't rake them up and put them in bags and send them to the landfill. If you can, you can't leave a thick layer of leaves on the grass over the winter because it's going to tend to hurt the grass. But what I do is I chew them up with the lawnmower. I call it composting in place. Chew them up. I go over it 3, 4, 5 times if I have to, and I'm done. I don't rake a thing.
God bless you, Bob Graves, because you gave me that idea a few years ago on this show. It has saved me so much. I don't, you know, I like to watch TV. I'm not too much for getting out there, frankly. And it saves a lot of time.
Especially nice if you have a riding mower, I must say.
I don't have that.
And it actually improves your soil, too, because the mulching blades actually get those pieces in.
It's the
best
thing you can do for the grass.
All the glass strippings, strip all the leaves, and really you're missing all that organic. You're really depleting your soil. So it's saving you work and making better soils.
If you're not going to do that and you're not going to send them to the landfill, just make a pile of them somewhere and let them compost.
Yeah.
Make a compost pile.
I mean, Mary, you could put the pile on the neighbor's lawn. Right? I mean, they usually don't mind. Don't do that. I'll get sued. Leave it on your own lawn. This is from Sandy in Johnstown, and we'll throw this one to Greg over in the corner office. We have a lovely foxglove that has bloomed all summer in a pot. Now that it has almost frozen, what do we do with it for the winter? And that's Sandy in Johnstown.
Well, it would be a great idea, as we've been talking about, you know, fall planting, would be a great idea to plant it, to actually put it in the ground, in a perennial border somewhere or some garden where it will return and bloom profusely next year. And then maybe even seed and spread around a little bit.
Anybody else?
I agree. Get it in the ground.
You still have time this year because it's giving us an extra little window with this mild weather.
All right, three more emails here. We'll take a quick break and hit the phones, 800-348-2551. This one's from Jay. What should we be doing this time of year for spring's sake? Weed prevention, seeding, pruning? We talked a little about this. Maybe, Fred, you'd like to further elucidate.
So he's asking, how do you suppress weeds?
What should we be doing at this time of year?
There's a lot of things you can do. This is great. I mean, we're really basically talking about stuff for winter protection. So if you have trees, you have shrubs, you want to try to fence them off preventatively so the rodents or critters don't come in and sort of browse on them. And the biggest things that we deal with are mostly in terms of damage is voles and rabbits. Voles have been very destructive. So those hardware cloth collars around your trees, some fencing around shrubs. Great time of year to start fertilizing. If you haven't already, you can put fertilizer down. And just like what Bob had mentioned before, in terms of getting the plants in the ground now so that the roots have time to sort of expand and grow, they're also actively gathering material. So if you put fertilizer down now, you're going to give that plant a little bit bolster health in the springtime. Top dressing compost on your perennial gardens. Good time to sort of top dress. And there are some things you can definitely plant right now as well with this kind of weather. You could probably move some stuff around as well.
Yeah, you could transplant now.
Transplant. Yeah, transplanting could. Is a good time. It's sleepy, the ground's workable, and hey, it's not raining.
It's not raining. Today.
One more email, then we'll take that break, and then we will go to the phones. We'll hit the email bag later in the show. This is from Beth, and Beth was concerned that she was too late. You're not too late. Beth writes, I live in Northampton. Yeah, is it too late to cut back and transplant a medium-sized butterfly bush? It's about 7 feet high. Greg, you're the Massachusetts guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, butterfly bush is something that could be moved now. They are, Northampton is a nice warm spot in Western Mass. In the Berkshires, it's a little colder, and it is a zone 6 plant. So you do want to protect it once you move it. So digging it up, making a nice tidy root ball, ideally not allowing it to go bare root, which means the soil stays intact around the shrub when you move it. And then once planted, water well, mulch the upper area about an inch and a half so that the plant is sort of kind of put to bed for the winter. In terms of pruning, if it's a 7-foot plant, yeah, a little light pruning would be helpful to make it a little more convenient to move. But if you don't have to do the pruning, I would wait until spring. And then in the spring, I would take it down by half or even a little more.
Anybody else very quickly?
Yeah. One thing I would mention is in the little bit colder areas, that plant often dies back to the ground. It almost acts like a herbaceous perennial. So in the spring, if you look at that and you think it's dead, wait. Because it still may come up from the ground.
Yeah, around us, we often have them die right back to the ground.
Right back.
So if you are in doubt, just do your little fingernail scratch on the branches and see if it's green, or get a knife or a pair of pruners and scratch the branches. If they're green, we generally leave them. And down, because it is a zone 6 plant, if you're down in a real mild area of the state, those will almost never die back, and they'll turn into 6-foot, 7-foot plants. But around us, especially at the Arboretum, they die back almost to the ground every year, but they're coming back, and they'll bloom. Because they form new flowers on new wood, they'll bloom prolifically even if they die back.
Let's take a quick break. It's Gardening Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Your call's coming up. Fox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's Gardening Today, the fun we have with Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Bob Graves. The number is 800-348-2551 if you'd like to join said fun. Marie is in Rochester. Marie, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much. I love your show, too.
Oh, thanks.
This particular show and these guys.
Yeah, it's great.
I have two questions. One on ginkgo tree, as it turns out. The roots are encroaching on the building where I live, and I'm wondering if some of those roots can be cut off, actually quite close to, or cut down into the ground and maybe trim back a little bit. And then the aconitum that I have is in distress. The leaves all turn brown on me, very like August to September, they start to turn brown. The flowers are gorgeous, but the leaves, I don't know what to do with.
Fred Breglia.
So that ginkgo, we'll start with that ginkgo. How old do you think that tree is? How big? How old?
Oh, I would say it's probably 30 years old.
Okay, so probably like maybe a foot and a half diameter trunk-ish? Something like that. And the roots are getting close to, you're seeing them by the foundation?
Yes.
Yep. So roots are generally opportunistic. They're going to grow where there's opportunity. Now, how far away would you say that plant is from the basement, the tree?
From the building?
Yeah, the tree. How far away?
I would say 20 feet.
20 feet away. It's closer than I'd like to see it, because over time the bigger roots will start to grow that way. But I don't think it's going to, if you have a solid foundation, it shouldn't just want to grow in. Sometimes they have issues with them growing into old homes, those old foundations that are kind of laid up stone. And again, roots are opportunistic, so they don't want to grow into concrete, solid concrete. They want to grow where there's water, there's air. And if there's an old stone sort of foundation, those roots can sometimes get in there, and when they do, they grow and they get fatter and they get bigger and they push walls. But generally, I don't think, you know, you're going to have too much problems with that on a bigger, more solid building. But if you did see roots going towards the building and you wanted to sort of clip them off, I don't think you're going to do a lot of damage by doing that. And so you really are talking smaller roots. I'm assuming by that point you wouldn't be cutting anything larger than maybe an inch.
Right.
I like to say sometimes that plants aren't stupid. You know, they're going to take the easy way usually.
Yeah. Generally, you should be good. They do make things if you had issues where you could cut them, and then they make root barriers that they can't penetrate. So that wouldn't be very hard to install, because the good thing about these roots are, other than the structural roots that are right around the trunk of the tree, which go down deeper and hold that tree, anchor that tree, these fibrous roots that feed the tree, which are all the ones that you're talking about and all the ones that go out everywhere, you know, they're really they're looking for material things, water and air and stuff, but they're also not going down more than 15 inches deep. So, you know, 15, 18 inches, you're not going to see too much more roots beyond that. So, you know, you're really only talking about 12, 15 inches of depth.
Okay, Marie.
Okay. And the aconitum?
You know, my guess is, from what you described, that we had such a wet year that you've got some leaf fungal problems on that. A lot of things defoliated early. I'm getting questions on lilacs and other things, variegated dogwood.
Well, this is the second year this has happened. I've had it in for about 3 years, and this is the second year.
I would guess it's weather-related both times. It'll probably come back in the spring. Go ahead, Greg.
They are a little susceptible to some bacterial leaf spot, which definitely would have been a problem this year, and could have been a problem last year, because though it was dry, the humidity was still pretty excessive, and so it could be that. And they also can be susceptible to mites. Mites can, and usually that's not so much a leaf problem as a flower bud problem, but one or the other, possibly both.
And the flowers are gorgeous.
So the flowers are coming out and they're fine. Yeah. So I would say that, bacterial leaf spot and leaf bite. And, you know, there are some fungal treatments you can do that. You know, better air circulation is always helpful. So if they're really dense and crowded or other things are around them, consider renovating, consider opening them up, consider making sure that air can kind of move around them.
Marie, thank you very much for the call. It's Gardening Today with Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Bob Graves. Laura's in Goshen. Hello, Laura.
Hi.
You're on.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to ask this question. We have large pieces on our property that, for some existential reasons, we weren't able to attend to. And so they have now become overgrown with three types of weeds, basically. Mm-hmm. We were able to clear these areas, but here the problem is, and I'm sure you know, the weeds have a root, and then the roots grow more roots, and those roots grow more plants. And it's like a huge network of all of this, these weeds underneath the surface.
Yeah.
We've taken hose to try to pull up all the roots, and we think we have them, and a few days later, they're back. Now, the three types mainly are, one is like a pricker bush, and that will grow one plant with all these roots to grow other plants, and then one end, the other end, grows into the ground and creates a new plant. Mm. The other one is a totally green that can go up a couple feet and has this unbelievable web of roots. And the other, people tell me it's either Creeping Charlie or a chokeweed. So what I'm asking, is there an environmentally way that we can get rid of these evil beings?
All right, before I hand it to the experts, Laura, let me tell you what I do. Surrender.
Yeah.
Just let it go. Just give in. It's nature.
Oh, there have been days. There have been days where I've thrown that hoe down.
All right, let's send
it. This is a curse.
Let's send it to Bob Graves.
Are we talking a small area? Or are we talking acres? Or how much space are we talking?
Oh, no, not acres. But I'd say, 20 by 15 feet would be one, and another one would be sort of like 10 by
and
10.
What do you want to ultimately do with this section?
Well, for some of them, we want to just get rid of them. Once they're gone, maybe I've heard there's a tarp you could put on mulch.
Is it a
and
lawn?
And then others we want to bring back and get a lawn there or be able to grow other things. So, yeah.
Well, I think Fred would agree with me and probably Greg, too, is that, you know, if I'd mow it down and then put some, as you say, black cloth or black plastic over it, cook it, and you might take a year, right, Fred?
If you put it on now, and that is what I would recommend. I would smother it by using either a black tarp, black plastic, a piece of landscape fabric, tarp it, cover it down, use some rocks, use some sticks to hold it down for the winds. By the time you get around to spring and planting, everything is going to be dead, and it'll basically be on its way to turning into compost.
Have to put weed killer or something on there like that.
No, I would not recommend any kind of weed killer like that. Easily could smother them. I'm gonna put a black in parts of our garden when we sort of get it if we ever get everything done. We're going to put some plastic down too to kind of keep those weeds at bay for the areas we're not going to be using.
Yeah.
And then I will say that, because you mentioned it, when you get this under control and if you want it to put plants, we don't recommend using weed barriers with the mulch on top around your plants. In the long term, that's going to become more of a maintenance issue.
Uh-huh.
So, and there's a lot of other things that weed barrier does that's not great for soils, but boy, it is great for smothering weeds. Then you take it off and you plant.
Where do you get that black tarp?
You could use any sort of agricultural grade black plastic that they sell for gardens. Most garden centers, I'm sure you guys carry it.
You can get it at one of the home centers or hardware store,
too. Or you could use a piece of weed fabric, which would basically be the same thing. I like weed fabric a little bit better only because, and it's the high-quality weed fabric, because it actually lets water and air down in.
Yeah.
And I think that's just better for soil health.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. I'll tell you what, Greg Ward is not with us, and so it's tough for Greg to jump in here, but we'll throw this one to you, Greg, and then we'll go around the room after you've had your say. Bob is in Rock Hill. Bob, you're on.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to mention to the gardening gods that I am very, very thankful to them for their suggestion of chop them up.
Yeah, buddy.
I just did my last mow for the year. And I chopped them up. I am no longer the pariah of the neighborhood, and you guys are the best. So thank you so much for that suggestion. It has saved my neck, my back, my everything.
Hey, man, that's great. That's not even a question for Greg, so he can continue to relax. Bob,
this was a medical show here.
Thank you very much for the call. Now we'll throw one to Greg. Peter in Glenville. Peter, you're on.
Hello. First, let me say I'm a huge fan of the Vox Pop.
Oh, thanks.
You're the best, Ray.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Lord have mercy.
Oh, exactly.
All right. I just had a quick question about using an all-natural method to kill the Japanese beetle grubs in my garden. And I heard that there's spores you can use, and there's one where you use, they're worms. They're some sort of a nematode, but it takes several applications, but it's very effective, but takes a while.
Greg Ward.
Well, yes, you know everything I know. There are there's a product that you can spread that's a bacteria that infects just Japanese beetle larvae specifically. So, and it does need to be applied over multiple seasons, and it's very effective. And nematodes can also work. The bacteria can be applied, you know, throughout the summer. You know, there's a few times to make that application. The nematodes, you do have to wait till June. They usually have a shorter shelf life, so it's a little harder to get a hold of them and get them applied at the right time. But if you want to go ahead with that, I'm sure you can find that product pretty much at any garden center. In season, you know, in May, and apply, you know, starting to apply it in June, July would be effective. Remembering that yes, you're going to have to do it for a couple of seasons in a row.
I'm definitely going to do that. I just, like, have you heard, like, is one a little better than the other? Or, you know, that's what I really, that was my, the basis of my call. Is one better than the other, or are they both the same?
The bacteria is probably a little better. It's going to be easier to apply. It's something that's more available in a couple of different forms. So I think that's going to be.
Wear a dust mask with that.
Yeah. Sometimes it comes in a granular form, though. So okay. It depends on which way it comes. I will say, you know, that there are, you know, beetle grubs that are not Japanese beetles that are in the lawn and can do some feeding as well, and it's not effective on them. It is specific to Japanese beetles.
Bob Graves.
Yeah, the milky spore is...
Thank you very much.
Milky spore is only effective against Japanese beetle grubs. There are three different types of grubs in this part of the world. You cannot tell the difference between the grubs without looking at the pattern of their hairs on their back end.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Come on, lying.
What the heck?
So, yes, if you got Japanese beetle grubs and you do it for a few years, it's probably effective. Let it be known that you can't use any other control when you do that because it doesn't work unless it infects the grubs to spread. It has to kill them in order to spread.
Can you just see this scenario playing out at Fatigan's? Where's the boss? Oh, he's out in the garden looking at the back ends of grubs.
I'll bring the microscope in for you. And you can.
He's not kidding.
It's fine.
I spent more time than I care to admit. Those various garden grubs.
Oh, it's really hard.
It is. They all look the same from a close inspection.
So what you're saying, Bob, is this is the less glamorous side of nursery.
Yes, this is gardening too.
Shelley and Saugerty. Shelley, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me now?
You back. Go ahead.
Okay, so I would say in September when I went outside to start getting the garden, adding soil and doing things, I noticed and had heard about these Asian worms, these very big, fat, long worms that have a circle about a third of the way down. There's a line around them.
Yeah.
You know about them?
I think Fred does.
Yeah. We're all familiar with the jumping worms, the Asian jumping worms. Yeah, it's an invasive. It's not a great... invasive to have it basically. If you want to make sure you're correctly IDing it, and if you do go to one of the local extensions, you could certainly get pictures. I know cooperative extensions have a lot of fact sheets on these around us. I know that you can go to the universities such as Cornell. They've got some great stuff on their websites about this as well. The more, you know, sort of the moral of the story here is that we don't want to make them spread any more than they have to. And the easy way to do it is just don't share plants that come from infected areas. You know, keep them there. If you see them, you can pick them out and you can sort of put them in a bucket and let them dry out. They'll desiccate very quickly. And then they can be composted after that. And, you know, generally these jumping worms aren't too deep. They sort of are more shallow. If you rake leaves, you often will see them sort of really squiggly, you know. They're a problem, but, you know, there's not a real great solution right now that's a cure-all. And right now prevention is urged more than anything else. The good news is that, you know, it's not going to kill your plants directly. It's just going to break down compost. And it's really bad when it gets into the wild because then it's breaking down the organic matters of forests, and that has even larger applications.
Shelley, by the way, and I did not put this link on this page today, but we have been talking about this throughout the summer on this program. And I think on the last show or maybe the one before that on our website, you will find a link to the Cornell or one of the university pages.
Yeah, I think it was Cornell.
On the Asian jumping worms. So if you go to WAMC.org and just put gardening in the search engine, you'll find all the shows. And if you find one over the summer, you'll find the link where it's a great resource for the jumping worms.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Let's take a break. Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum. Bob Graves from Fatigan's Nursery, Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, and everybody's here. We'll get back to your calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Gardening Today with Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Bob Graves. The number is 800-348-2551. A couple of emails here, gentlemen, and then back to the phones we'll go for the home stretch. This one's from Ernie in Scotia. Is Japanese maple invasive?
No. Absolutely not. Nope. Japanese maple is a lot of plants are from different parts of the world, and they often do quite well here and vice versa. Some of those plants create issues. Japanese maple is definitely not one. It's an awesome specimen plant.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can't say enough great things about it.
Greg.
I could just add quickly, though. They do, you know, so there is a definition of invasive, and that's something that, you know, is a noxious weed and is self-propagates. In non-cultivated areas, et cetera. But there are extremes to that. And Japanese maples do recede, but you don't find them taking over the edge of the forest as like a Norway maple would do. So,
exactly.
So I can see why you might think that's a possibility. They can recede, but they are not considered invasive.
This one's from Darren. I wasn't able to get my garden ready this year for some perennials I had purchased this fall. I need to move them inside now, but is the basement too warm? Will it disturb their dormant period if it's too warm? I feel like the garage is still too cold, and that's from Darren. Bob Graves.
Yeah, I would rather not see them where it's warm. You don't want them to think that it's spring and start growing. What's nice is like an attached garage that might be moderate in temperature. I have done this sort of thing a number of times, and my garage is moderate in temperature. You know, it'll freeze, but not very much. But then when I put them in the barn, which is not moderate in temperature, they don't make it.
Okay. This one from Wayne in Stone Ridge. I'll throw this one to you, Fred. My garlic heads never get very big, usually small and pathetic. I cut the scapes. I try to water them well. What's the key to getting good-sized heads of garlic? And that's from Wayne in Stone Ridge.
All right. Well, you know, fall planting, I'm not sure if he's doing – you can plant garlic in the fall and spring, but fall planting is definitely the ideal way to go to get larger garlic.
Yeah.
And the larger the clove you plant, the bigger the bulb you're going to get. So when we do garlics, we generally set aside the largest single cloves and really careful not to bruise them, too. It's like a lot of people think garlic's really tough.
Yeah.
It's not quite as tough as an onion. It's actually more like an apple it can bruise.
Interesting.
And so if you're beating them all up, you're bruising them, and although they might grow, it's certainly not going to set them ahead. It's going to set them back. So fall planting, I always recommend mulching over top of it, like straw works really well. Weed suppression, you want to get weeds away from your garlic because they're going to end up reducing the size of the bulb. And really large cloves, fall planting with large cloves, good seed source. Bad seed source, you know, garlic's not created equal.
Great.
So get it from a good seed source.
Yeah, I would just add a good spacing and good sun. So, you know, extended day, don't put them in a part sun spot. And, you know, 8 or 10 inches on center in a row, and the rows should be more like 12 inches apart. You can make them farther apart than that, but that usually works pretty well.
Greg, you do the garlic often. I know you brought some in for me to try to grow, and I do have a confession to make that we ate the garlic, but so we never actually grew it. But you do that a lot, though, right?
Yeah, so Fred does it a lot too, and it's a really easy thing to do, but you don't want to jam them all together. And then, as Fred said, a mulch is really helpful because it just allows for that weed suppression. They're hungry, so all vegetables are hungry. So adding some nutrients to the soil when you plant or again in spring in May or June when they're really developing is helpful. I usually like to kind of do a top dress of an organic fertilizer sometime in mid-late spring.
It's the Gardening Show on Vox Pop. Our number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum. Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery. Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery. And we go to Millerton. Timothy, you're on.
Hello. I recently saw my neighbor spreading ash in his garden. Straight from his fireplace or wherever. Is it true that it adds like nutrients and things to make the soil where you're planting more fertile? He called it potash. I guess it puts potassium into the soil, hence the name potash.
Yep.
I was just wondering if that was true and if you can use it in either like a flower bed garden or a vegetable garden.
Bob or Fred or Greg, somebody take it.
Go ahead, Greg.
So, yes, it is a source of potassium. And, yes, you can use it in your garden as long as, you know, what you're burning is nice, clean firewood. The things to consider when you're doing it is how much do you put in? Yeah. It's a little hard to measure exactly how much you're putting in. And what is the pH of your soil now? Because not only does it add potassium, but it does raise the pH.
Yeah, you got to be really careful not to put too much of that down. It is a source of nutrient, but you can overdo it really easy.
Yeah, we always say a little bit of ash is good. A lot of ash, usually not. But I wouldn't put any ash directly in my garden without doing a pH test. Yep. It has a really strong buffering capacity to alkalize soil. So it'll actually sweeten the soil. A lot of times we burn wood and our ash, we don't use too much of it. We throw a little bit of our wood ash into our compost and it's part of the compost product. But you got to be really careful. Test the pH of your garden just because you've got it. It can cause, I've seen people really mess things up by adding ash. Because it'll change the pH so much that the plant won't pull up material.
What happens
when the pH
is off, a plant can't get the nutrients that are in the soil.
Yeah. Right.
It's like being at a buffet table with tape on your mouth.
Oh, yeah, man.
You could be, for example,
rhododendron. I've had that dream. Let me tell you something.
I've seen rhododendrons that show iron deficiencies because the pH is too sweet. You lower the pH by adding sulfur, the iron deficiency goes away. If you didn't diagnose that correctly, you just keep adding iron, you're going to end up locking up even more problems, but the plant still is not going to get the iron. So pH is a huge, very, very powerful and important part of gardening.
So let me ask you a question. Timothy, thanks for the call. Theoretical question, very quickly.
Go ahead.
We'll get to the next call. So conifers, or I don't know what kind of evergreen is in our backyard, but underneath they drop needles, and there's no grass. I assume that is because the soil is acid.
It's more shade than acid.
Oh, really? It's not an acidic?
I have people all the time come and say, I've got evergreens, so my soil is acid, and we check it, and it's not.
Interesting.
Yeah, also not enough moisture, because that plant will, those evergreens are really great at, they're built for snow shedding and water shedding, so all that stuff is like a roof, pitched roof.
So in other words, the second part of my question was, if I took some ashes from my barbecue grill and just put a thin coating there, would it possibly gain some green underneath?
I don't think you're going to get much green because, again, that problem is really more of a light and moisture issue.
Okay.
The sun is the energy source for plants to grow. Yeah. If there's no sun, there's no growth.
Okay. If you limbed up the plants more, like some of the lower branches, and let more light in, then you'd start to see things probably get a little greener.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. And Faye in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi, so glad you took my call. Can you hear me okay?
Sure thing.
Very good. This is a question about my endless summer hydrangeas that are by my front entrance, so I look at them all the time. They're now about 5 feet high. I've had them for several years. So we've had our killing frosts. They are now in the horrific, ugly stage of all of those dead brown leaves, which I can't bear to look at as I enter my house. So I have done what people tell me not to do. Some people tell me not to do. I have cut them down to 12 to 15 inches in late fall. And I'm wondering, does that really do a lot of harm for the spring blossoms? I have to say that last summer, maybe it was all the rain, they bloomed more than they ever have. But is that really a bad thing to do to endless summer hydrangeas?
What we're finding with endless summers, and they've been out for a number of years now, and sometimes people really have trouble getting them to bloom properly. And what the books are saying now is that you need to fertilize them more than you think, because they need to get some growth on them. So I start in March fertilizing, and I go every month with an organic granular type. You got to feed them, and then they seem to bloom much better. So you have cut them back. Some people say cut them back in the spring. Some people say cut them back in the fall.
Right.
Some people do both. I think it's more a matter of making sure they've got a lot of nutrient in the spring to get them back to bloom.
Greg.
Greg,
go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I think that if you have the experience that they have, you have done this in the past and they bloomed for you, just fine, then you're all set. I think doing what you're doing is fine, leaving enough wood to still get some growth that will have some, you know, some spring bud development forming is going to do it. And if you're fertilizing in addition, as Bob said, I think you're all set.
Great, Fred.
So, let me ask.
Go ahead.
When should I end fertilizing? Should I do some now?
Oh, you could do some now. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, fertilizing when things are sleeping, or going to sleep, like dormancy, that's a good time. If fertilizing too early in the fall, generally sometimes is right. not recommended because it could push late season growth, which is almost guaranteed to get injury from the winter temperatures. Mm-hmm. But other than that, with those, I think you're pretty straightforward. I generally don't do much pruning on them till spring. But again, I don't think, you know, it sounds like what you've got working there is certainly right on.
Whenever somebody says this works, don't change.
And when you say it bloom nicely on those, because a lot of people have a hard time getting those to bloom nicely. And when you said you did, it's like Greg said, I think we'd tell you to keep going.
So here's a harder question that I really don't know about. I'd love to be able to control the height a little bit. They're 5 feet now. I would like them to be like 4 feet. Can I pinch back some of the early growth in the spring, or am I just, that's not going to work? They're just going to grow to what they grow to.
I personally don't like to pinch those types of hydrangeas back. You will probably not get the desired result you're looking for, and you'll probably get less blooms. Greg or Bob may have something else to say about that.
Greg.
Just that when they grow, when they sprout, and you know, a few weeks have gone by, or say 10 days have gone by, it's middle of May, you usually can now squeeze the tip of the new growth and find the flower bud in there. And it probably won't be in every one, but there'll be hopefully enough of them, as you described before. And so anyone that has that little green bud hiding in there, don't pinch that one. But anything that's missing, you could certainly pinch back.
The other thing you might want to consider if you really have a problem with the height is there are newer varieties that don't get as tall.
Okay.
Yep.
Faye, thanks a lot for that one. The number is 800-348-2551. Barry's in Vermont. Barry, where are you in Vermont? Or are you in Barry, Vermont? Barry's not anywhere. Hello, Barry.
Oh, one more time.
Barry, are you there? He nodded off. I apologize. You know, it does take a while. The lines get very loaded on this program. Thankfully, not the guests. John in New Lebanon. John, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm calling about an oak leaf hydrangea, which I've had for about 5 years. It bloomed. It just sent like one bloom the first year. And since then, nothing. And I'm in New Lebanon. I'm west of Pittsfield, Mass. It's a zone 5, and it's a ruby slippers oak leaf hydrangea. I don't know if it's a question of not enough sun or just too cold. Mm. I have it about 10 feet off the north side of the house, and it does, in season, get a fair amount of sun in the morning and in the mid to late afternoon. So I don't know what to do now.
Greg Ward, you're in Massachusetts, aren't you?
I am. But the first question is, you're not pruning it back, as the lady just described earlier. You're not going at it this fall or spring or anything. You're leaving it intact and letting it grow out in the spring?
Yes, yes. It hasn't gotten more than 3 feet in height, and any height difference after that is not a problem. So I haven't been doing that, no.
Right. And that's because the buds are set now for this coming blooming season in 2022. So any severe pruning or significant pruning you do will limit that. And then, as you suggested, both light and temperature can affect the bloom. Now, last winter, there wasn't a temperature issue for our zones, our areas. So it may be a light issue, and it also could be a nutrient issue. Lastly, did you say it's only been a couple of seasons, or you've had it for quite some time?
I've had it for at least 5 years, And first year it put up a flower, but again, that's because of whatever had happened to it in the nursery.
Correct. Yeah. So, and are you fertilizing?
No flowering. Yes, I am. I don't know right now what kind I'm using. One of the Espomas, but whichever one I read was best for oak leaf hydrangeas.
Yeah, so I mean, you guys jumped in, but it sounds like we've determined that maybe light is the only variable.
Yeah, I think so. That's a plant that grows very well in the shade, but a lot of plants that grow well in the shade don't get quite enough light to flower. And it's not a discrete thing. I mean, there's enough light for it to flower, and then you get a little less light and a little less light and a little less light, and then all of a sudden there's not enough light for it to flower. So I'd almost be willing to bet that's what it is.
John, thanks a lot for the call. We only have 2 minutes left here. Let's go to Wilbraham and Mary. You're on. Hello?
Oh, hi. I'm just wondering about Japanese knotweed. Is there any new treatment for it?
No, you're trying to get rid of it. I mean, it depends on what you want to do. But mowing, it's not a new treatment, but it's very effective. We've got rid of the vast majority of the knotweed Atlantis just from cutting it. You just got to keep after it, and you'll wear it down. It doesn't like to be mowed. It also could be smothered, depending on... if it's in an area where you could, you know, put some of that black plastic or weed barrier that we've talked about for smothering other weeds, it certainly will work like that. It does have that fibrous root system that we've talked about as well, and that means when you pull it out, you often break out a lot of pieces. So you really got to try to dig it out. But the easiest way to do it is, and it works very much. Just if you can mow it, and mow it short, don't let it grow. You'll win.
May take 5 years to get rid of it.
We did it in less, but
smothering is tough because I've seen it come up through blacktop.
Oh, it's terrible stuff. Oh, yeah, it's an endless battle, Mary. Well, thank you for that one very quickly, and we only have exactly 1 minute. Terry in Amherst. Terry, you're on.
Oh, hi. I grew Montauk daisies for the first time this year, and they're in the garden now, and they're just long and leggy. I never cut them back. So do I just leave them and then cut them in the spring, or can I cut them back now?
Greg.
And how far?
Yeah, so if they're finished, the bloom is totally spent and you don't like them anymore, you can cut them back like any other perennial, you know, 2-3 inches high is fine.
Oh, okay, very good. Thank you very much. Perfect. Oh,
very good. Thanks a lot, Terry. Fred, anything going on over at Landis?
Visit landisarboretum.org. That's our website. There are going to be some winter programs, and we're starting to already work on 2022 calendar events. So visit the website. And cool. The grounds of the Arboretum are open year-round, dawn to dusk. Free charge.
Greg Ward, what's happening at Ward's Nursery?
Well, we're changing seasons. The planting season is beginning to end, and the Christmas season. Can I say that already? Even though it's
you
before
can
Thanksgiving?
To me. My wife has already put up decorations, so you can say whatever you want. It's
yeah,
Santa's workshop
begun.
In my house.
It's begun.
All right,
it has begun.
Bob Graves, anything at Fatigan's we need to know about?
Well, it's the Christmas trees are not coming next week, but the week after.
Wow. Ho, ho, ho.
Rees and the greens next week.
All right.
Time.
Gentlemen, well, thank you for this one. That was a fun one, and we appreciate you all being here. Support comes from Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. InterimHealthcare.com. At Hudson Valley House Parts, Newburgh, an architectural salvage store sourcing large-scale architectural antiques and vintage components for use by preservationists, architects, designers, and homeowners, HV House Parts on Instagram. Once again, thanks to Bob Graves, Fred Breglia, and Greg Ward for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, it is a topic very close to my very clogged heart. We'll talk healthy eating with Holly Shelowitz tomorrow on a Food Friday. That's at 2 p.m. I think you're going to enjoy it. Right now, stand by for another thing you'll enjoy. I didn't write it down, but you'll enjoy it.